KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Because I am not going to run for mayor.
I kind of like that music that went with that. That was Ron Simms saying he wasn't running for mayor on Monday. See, maybe that's why it's just been a long week. I thought we did this together last week, but apparently I wasn't here.
We did this together.
You guys were there. But I
we're here.
Oh, well, I listened to you. Hence, I felt like I was in the room with you. I was listening. We also heard is Mossback at crosscut.com, an author of Space Needle, the Spirit of Seattle. Good to see you all.
Good to see you.
Good morning.
See, whether we are in the room or listening, we all feel a part of this panel.
Yeah. But I think you were one of those crank callers last week.
I clearly was. I clearly was. That's right. You guys were talking about this last week with Marcy. All right. I got a big rejection of Pope Mania for a topic from you folks. So leave us to then let you curmudgeon say why you don't want to talk about the Pope or why there's been too much coverage of the Pope.
Well, it has been overkill.
May I just say Buenos Aires to start this?
it's just been overkill. The live coverage,
you get the camera and CNN, the camera just all through CNN's coverage, even when they went to commercials on the smokestack.
Well, the coverage of the BBC on KUOW, they're standing around the square filled with people who are going to cheer for the Pope, and it's what else are they going to do? I mean, it just seems, and I think maybe it has to do with the fact that I'm a heathen and live in Seattle, the city of nuns, as in people with no religious affiliation being a very high percentage. It just seems the coverage of it is completely out of proportion.
Isn't it akin to the Queen's Jubilee?
I mean, usually out of proportion.
We all kind of gathered around. Yeah, okay. Or the U.S. Yeah. presidential campaign.
And granted, I mean, it has an effect politically and that kind of thing. But, he's the head of state of the tiniest country. And, I just think there are more important things to talk about.
Anti-Pope mania?
The Pope feels a little played out at this point. But I was thinking that about this in comparison to the presidential election that you mentioned. And the difference is I had a vote in the presidential election. So I cared, and every single person in the United States who's eligible to vote was theoretically invested. There are a lot of Catholics in the world, and there are a lot of Catholics in the United States. And like you said, this does have some political impacts. But what it really is a suspense narrative that none of us have any part in unless we're a cardinal.
Pope mania? Can you give me some positive?
Well, let me
Pope
attempt
mania?
A defense. I mean, listen, I'm from TV. I am entirely sure that we probably overplayed it, though I did not.
Did Fox?
We actually did not cut into programming. We were the only
Station?
Yeah, I believe it didn't cut in to programming. But having said that, this was, well overdone, I'm sure, having not seen it all. But listen, this is a leader of not a country, but of over a billion people worldwide in this Catholic faith, which is hugely important to those followers. It's a big sort of, phenomenon around the world. And it strikes me that overplayed a bit, but listen, a couple days of live coverage, I can live with that. We have beat to death other things on cable TV, like very, very irrelevant crimes in Aruba and other things. So, as things go, this is more important than a lot of things that are beaten to death on cable TV.
It always seems like it has the same outcome, though. Everybody's really excited, and then and the Pope is going to be the best Pope ever. And then people, right afterwards, it's like, oh, he's old, he's white, he doesn't like gays. And has a sketchy background of supporting some kind of regime that nobody thinks is that great. The Pope who resigned was had been in the Hitler Youth. I mean, it just seems like there's always this great outpouring and then kind of sudden reality hits.
The strength of that outpouring was one of the more interesting parts of this, I thought, a great reminder that U.S. Catholics at least have a very strong hope, a large segment of them, that there will be a pope someday who is more progressive on gay marriage and who doesn't have, like you're saying, a sketchy past that involves either the Hitler Youth or
complicity with the junta,
right,
in Argentina.
I think one thing that struck me was, goes a little bit to Knut's point, you had a lot of young people in St. Peter's Square, you know, getting super excited, and, you know, and out walks a 76-year-old. So
just like when the Rolling Stones play.
Right. For me, there is a slight disconnect with the youth energy of that day and who this guy is and who any of them would be, for that matter. I mean, most of them are pretty old. And the choice strikes me as a sort of shore up your base. I mean, you know, they're actually hemorrhaging Catholics in Latin America. They've been losing market share, and they needed to find a pope who helped, you know, represent that new world and can keep it alive there. They need Latin America still in their fold.
One of the things in this kind of ADHD challenge society that impresses me is the fact, I mean, I recognize certainly that the church is a one of the pillars of Western civilization, and the fact that it's lasted so long, that they have a bureaucracy and a process. So they can say things like, well, this is the first pope in 1,300 years who's come from outside Europe. Or, you know, this is the first pope in 600 years who resigned. There is a lesson in continuity there that is pretty unmatched otherwise in Western civilization.
That, and for me, the coverage that kept going on about how he was going to be fighting the entrenched corrupt entrenched corrupt bureaucracy of the Vatican and Vatican City, I thought.
And I think that actually is one of the more likelier outcomes of this choice. This is not a person – I mean, listen – he's elected by cardinals who were appointed because they approve of church orthodoxy. So there's not going to be a change in sort of, you know, women becoming priests and views on contraception, abortion. That's all not changing. But sort of control over the Vatican. They've had problems with the Vatican Bank. There are all kinds of sort of problems with that. And I think an outsider who can sort of reform that is probably actually the most likely outcome of this choice.
All right, we'll leave it there. I was listening to you all on Friday when you all said that with that poll coming out for Ron Sims and Mike McGinn at about 15% each, that maybe it'd be good for Mike McGinn if Ron Sims went into the race because it would further divide. But as you also said, and then if he came through, Mike McGinn would have a hard time. So I think Ron Sims, CR, did Mike McGinn a favor by not running?
I do, and I was probably the strongest proponent of that argument last week. That, listen, Ron getting in would have split the anti-McGinn vote that much more, and I think therefore kind of helped McGinn. You know, Ron's kind of in this weird Zen place, and I must say he's gotten, dare I say, odd in his sort of, you know, post-political career. He almost whispers. He talks about finding his mountain. I mean, this is a guy that should be at a yoga retreat, not in a mayor's race.
Clearly that's what they decide.
Yeah, so I think he did the right thing just for himself. He's just not in a state to be doing this. But yes, I think McGinn was the one that was most upset by the news of Ron not getting in.
You think McGinn was the most upset? You think
absolutely.
It hurts?
Absolutely.
You think it hurts McGinn?
Absolutely.
You think it
hurts McGinn to not have Ron in the race?
I disagree with that. I do agree, just based on Ron Sims' Facebook page, that there is something going on. There's a lot of aphorisms that pop up in my Facebook feed every day from Ron Sims about mountains and finding your bliss. And actually, I appreciate it. But it's different messaging than I've heard from Sims in the past. The poll, I pulled it up because I thought you might ask about it. The poll that King 5 did showed that if Sims got out of the race, McGinn jumped up from 15% to 19%. McGinn benefited most of all the candidates from Sims not being in the race. So I actually have a 180, you know, degrees different view on this just based on the poll results. I think McGinn is happy that Ron stayed out.
I think that Ron getting out helps helps McGinn a little bit, but I think it really helps the rest of the field. The person who's really taking advantage of that now is Ed Murray. He's taken the conditional exploratory off this week. That was almost immediately after. He's in the race with both feet. Of course, he was before the legislature went into session. He demonstrated a fair amount of fundraising prowess, and I think he's going to McGinn is going to have his sort of group of supporters, and then you've got Burgess, Murray, and Steinbrück in particular, and Bruce Harrell. I wouldn't count him out either, but all those guys are going to benefit because Sims will not be a further dividing of votes. They'll be able to compete now without another, big magnet in there.
And there was that 34% undecided that registered in the poll.
Which is significant.
It's absolutely significant. It would change the game for any of the contenders in there if some portion of that undecided block, over 15% of it, say, or over 15% of the total group responding, move to any one candidate. That would totally change the race. On the Murray question, and we talked about this a little bit last week, I was surprised at how low Murray was in the poll that King 5 did. Now, this is relatively speaking, and this is during the legislative session. But I also read Murray's announcement that he is not conditionally running for mayor, but absolutely running for mayor, as one way that he can, with the restrictions in place about politicking during the legislative session, one way that he can remind people, hey, I'm still here.
Right. As a sitting legislator, he can't raise money while it's in session.
Well, but he can do everything else. I mean, he can go to candidate forums, and he can call people, and he can knock on doors, and he is doing all that.
Yeah, and I mean, one challenge you have that Ed Murray has, really well known in his key district, but not particularly well known. It's not a household word outside of that. He has accomplishments. He has experience in some of the key areas that I think a lot of people would like to see a mayor have experience, transportation being one of those big things. But he's got a campaign. He's got to get out there and, like you say, knock on doors and really, really let it be known. And I think that's one of the things. I mean, my feeling was when you got the scoop that Ron was pulling out, that this is when the race really begins.
Hmm. By the way, just on that, McGinn was here the hour before and Sims was in the green room and I was stuck here. So I do not know if they passed each other and spoke, if one knew something, if they both knew what was happening. I don't know what happened, but I was here.
Zen meditation advice from Sims.
I did get that.
Sims didn't say who he was leaning toward.
No,
he's not endorsing anybody because I think that might be helpful to somebody.
Somebody. So.
Just one quick thing. I think part of the reason that Ed scored lower on the recent poll than you might have thought is he's the only one in this race that has not the major figures who has not run citywide. So, I mean, you have McGinn, you have Burgess, you have Steinbrück, you have Harrell. All of them have been on multiple citywide ballots. Now, Ed's been around a long time, but he's been in the 43rd district. So, University District and Capitol Hill, Madison Park, that sort of area knows him. But he isn't particularly well-known citywide.
The other challenge he has right now is that he's needed in Olympia. He could begin campaigning more forcefully in Seattle, but the fact is he's very important to discussions that are going on in Olympia that will affect Seattle. And if he's seen as not tending to those issues, it will be a vulnerability for him in the mayor's race.
Hmm. Go ahead.
I just want to go back to the transportation just for a minute because it ties into some things that happened this week or that we've been talking about. One of them is I did a story a few weeks ago about all the transportation projects that are going to be coming online during the next mayor's term. So if you look at 2014, 2015, 2016, you've got North Link Light Rail, 520 Bridge, the tunnel, the Mercer fix, a new trolley line. You have just a ton of transportation stuff coming online. Now, one of the things that we've learned is that some of those mega projects are troubled, 520, and so they're bringing in Ron Pananen, who used to work on the Viaduct project, to come in and do a review of how WashDOT is handling their mega projects, because the study that was done about the pontoons revealed serious problems of oversight within WashDOT. The next mayor, whoever it is going to have to focus a lot on transportation and being the advocate for the city to make sure as these projects come online, those areas that have not been carefully defined in terms of the surface effects and the connecting of that network is going to be really important. If I were Ed Murray, I would really speak to the transportation integration planning and his experience there, because I think it's going to be critical.
I'll tell you what, let me follow up on those issues of what the campaign is going to be or could be about. We're talking about the news of the week, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, Eli Sanders. We'll take a break.
It's 1021, KUOW 94.9. A traffic note, the 520 bridge will be closed this weekend starting tonight at 11 to help with the overflow. On Saturday, the I-90 express lanes will be open westbound from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. On Sunday, the I-90 express lanes will be open westbound all day beginning at 7 a.m.
KUOW and Seattle Repertory Theater present Good People, a comedy of class and culture. Life is hard in South Boston, and Margie is out of luck. An encounter with her high school sweetheart leaves her wondering if life is about choice or chance. Playing March 8th through the 31st. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Bainbridge Graduate Institute, with master's programs committed to developing leaders of change. Open house March 20th at their new location in Pioneer Square. RSVP and more information at bgi.edu.
52 degrees in Seattle's University District. Expect a high in the mid-50s today with clouds. Showers likely. Also breezy, a wind 8 to 13 miles an hour. And tonight, slow in the upper 40s with clouds and a 40% chance of showers.
We are with at Eli J. Sanders. And we are with at C.R. Douglas Q13 Fox. And you can friend Knute Berger on Facebook. So you can find out what they're thinking throughout the week. And you'll know, you'll have anticipation by the time they come here on Fridays when we review the news of the week with Eli Sanders, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger. Katie Sewell, producer of the show, was in the green room, by the way. And she does say McGinn and Sims passing there on Monday. They did talk, but Ron wouldn't tell Mike if he was running or not. Ooh, that must have been frustrating. Mike left the studio before the announcement was made. All right, so one thing, you mentioned transportation in this mayor's race. One thing that Sims made the case for and was trying to make the case that perhaps this is what a big city mayor should talk about now, was the state of education. And I kept coming back to him saying, look, you're not running for superintendent. You're not running to head the school board. Why would this be what a mayor should be focused on? He said his argument was that in the end, a city's quality of education is what drives the rest of a city's quality of life. Is that, and I for right now, for me listening at this, so far this race is pretty much about, well, I'm not that guy. I'm not McGinn because he's just a hot-headed obstructionist, which he's trying to, work through and making arguments for the things he's accomplished, including his accomplishments in education. Is Sims right? Is this the way this race should play out?
I think he's right, and he's also wrong. I think he's right insofar as, sure, schools and quality of schools does affect the city and affects quality of life and all the rest. But I think he's wrong in the idea that this will play a part in the mayor's race. I mean, education sort of comes up in mayor's races, but the fact of the matter is people don't typically vote on education when it comes to the mayor's race. They leave that for school board races. You know, I mean, Mayor Rice started the Families and Education Levy. There's a little bit of energy with
part
him
of Rice's,
on this.
That was part of his campaign, too, yeah.
But at the end of the day, you don't have control over schools. It's sort of marginal effect. And this is not what voters vote on when they're voting for a mayor.
I agree. In the abstract, Sims is right. You know, I believe the children are the future. True. But it's not something that the mayor really controls unless the mayor is prepared to take over the schools. As McGinn hinted, he might be a little bit during the campaign and then backed way away from after he was elected. But other than that, it's not something that the mayor is going to play a huge part in. Obviously, the Families and Ed Levy is important. But other than that, not a huge role for the mayor and not something people seem to want the mayor talking about more than, say, potholes or transportation and other issues, crime.
I mean, you have Rahm Emanuel, you have Mayor Bloomberg, you have L.A.'s mayor, all sort of making the schools, the quality of schools, part of their discussion as they go about their work. What do you think?
Well, it should be part of a discussion. Running the school district is a whole different issue. I don't think it's a challenge. As Eli pointed out, McGinn's main issue when he announced, he had three main issues, but the biggest one was quality of education and playing this card, which said that if during his term the schools didn't improve significantly, that should be used as a measure as to whether he should be reelected or not. And that was, you know, that was his sort of opening statement. And then the discussion was, so one, McGinn has already put education in the race as a measurement of his performance. He would point, I'm sure, to the Families and Education Levy, which was much bigger this time, as a way that without running the school district, the city, by almost consensus, is willing to spend resources to support around schools, you know, with health programs and after school programs and that kind of thing. So education is in the race that way. And I think I agree with everybody. You know, Sims is right. But running the school district, actually getting in, and that's kind of like embracing a tarantula or something. I mean, it is a mayor at this point does not want to have to get in, and actually it may not even be good policy. Education will also be in the race because Burgess has embraced the sort of education reform, teacher evaluation type of approach that some of which the unions don't, teachers union doesn't like. So it will play a factor in the race. And yes, it is a major measure of whether a city, I think, is succeeding or not.
Just a quick comment about it. I mean, he did. Knut's right. I mean, when he announced McGinn in 2009, he had these three planks. Education was right up there. But he went pretty silent pretty quickly. I mean, that ended up not being what his campaign was about. It became about the tunnel. It became about sort of transportation. It became about other stuff. I think he quickly realized, and he got a lot of criticism, actually, for putting education in his plank, because people said, wait a second, you're not the superintendent. You're not running for that. You're not even running for school board. And he basically listened to that criticism. And you haven't heard much about it. And there's a lot of sort of touted of the Families and Education Levy, yes, and the sort of wraparound services it provides. But no one in this race wants to be tied to, you know, the performance of the schools, because they do not have direct control over it. And if you start putting test scores in measurements, it's McGinn's not trying to do that now.
Well, what they do have, what they are going to be tied to and what they do have control over is the police department. And this whole week was about, and last week for you guys as well, is about this SPD reform plan. A judge put it in place, and he was pretty vociferous about the parties being party to it and not thinking it wasn't fixed, that this was a legal document. You know, litigation is, this is it, boys, he was saying to McGinn. That's going to be, you said transportation. Isn't this SPD reform plan going to loom over all the discussions about what's happening in the mayor's race?
I don't think so.
You don't?
I think it's important. I think public safety is important. I think it will be discussed. We've already seen McGinn bringing up certain issues to kind of push back against Burgess's expertise in the area of policing and whatnot. I think that if McGinn can kind of stay with the team, which is a challenge for him, but if he can sort of stay with the team, I think these things will have a chance to roll out in such a way that they can demonstrate some progress. And if not, it could descend into finger pointing. I certainly think it's a political issue in terms of what happened in the feuding between the city attorney Pete Holmes and McGinn, in terms of McGinn trying to be sort of on good team player behavior and then suddenly going back to form and then quickly back. Talk about quickly backing off. he was in full bull run retreat on that. And then so it'll be interesting. It's an area of vulnerability. And, of course, the future of the police chief, Diaz, has already been injected in the race because we have at least one candidate who has pledged to fire the chief.
That's Burgess.
Yes.
Excuse
right.
me. McGinn actually tweeted out a picture of him smiling with his arm around the city attorney.
Pete Holmes, week, really?
Pete Holmes, when he was trying to make nice. I think that the reaching of a deal or the judge coming forward with what the deal is going to be going forward gives McGinn an opportunity to turn the page. So I agree somewhat with Knute. This will play out, and it remains to be seen how it plays out. But it does give McGinn a chance to say, hey, I fight hard for what I believe in. I fight hard for the city. I thought some things with this plan needed to be tweaked. The judge made his decision. Now we're going to implement it. That's in the past. Let's move on. We all want the SPD to improve. The wild card there, at least for the moment, is the SPD unions or the Seattle Police Union's lawsuit against the proposal, which I haven't heard, and maybe I missed, but I haven't heard McGinn make a statement on either way.
I haven't heard that either, though Merrick Bob was not happy about it.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of negative reaction to it, and I wonder where McGinn and the other mayoral candidates will land on this, and also how it will play out in court.
Just coming back to this question of how big this will play, I think it will be big, the whole DOJ police reform. I mean, it's Exhibit A for McGinn challengers in his leadership style. And this race is going to be about that sort of narrative, leadership style. It's not going to be about one particular issue. And this plays right into, I mean, it was sort of delivered on a silver platter to challengers. Certainly they think it was. In this sort of, you know, picking fights that he wasn't going to win. You're not going to win with the DOJ, and you're actually not going to win with Pete Holmes backing down. You know, he was going to eventually lose and had to back down and did lose. This is exactly what challengers sort of want to show, is his leadership style is sort of, you know, bomb throwing, can't build a coalition, doesn't do well with others. You know, McGinn's got some retorts to that, but this is exactly,
that's the narrative they're going to want.
Going to be a huge part of the debate because it's such grist for challengers, this DOJ fight.
You know, McGinn wants to shift that. Can he shift that as debates go on? I mean, every time it's going to be there'll be a forum and they'll be doing that, and then he'll say, here's what I've accomplished, and he'll list those things off. Is that effective for political leaders?
Well, yeah. I mean, reminding people of your accomplishments and doing what you can to frame the debate in a way that's favorable to you. I mean, you'd be crazy not to do that. I think one of the things that some of the challengers should look at, and I think this is an opportunity for Peter Steinbrück and for Ed Murray, is they can say, hey, change is good. The city needs change. It needs fresh ideas. It needs people who aren't on the city council, who aren't at city hall, who aren't. You know, I think they can play an outsider card. And a change agent card. Peter Steinbrück was on the city council, but he hasn't been for some time. He's been off to Harvard. He's done other things. He, as stylistically as a politician, he's always been a kind of an outsider. Ed Murray is going to be introducing himself to a lot of Seattle voters for the first time. You know, I would bang on the change thing. Even if I were Burgess or Harrell or whatever, I would bang on the change thing, because that poll shows you that people aren't happy with the status quo. Yeah. And you make the mayor embody the status quo.
All right. I'll come back to the mayor stuff. Let me go away from that. Let me talk about some of the things that happened in the state house. So universal background gun buyer check that died. the question is, will supporters have the support to bring it up on the ballot? And more, maybe a bigger question, is this a good or a bad year to bring that up in Washington State? 2013 is an off year. We'll have a vote for mayor, but what brings us to the ballot otherwise? What do you think, Sierra?
Well, it's not a good year to go to the ballot for something like universal background checks, and that's exactly why it died in the State House this week. I mean, Jamie Peterson leading this was trying to sort of corral 50 votes for universal background checks. The only way he felt like he could get that, excuse me, was to add a clause, a referendum clause to this legislation that said, okay, it passes out of the House and legislature here, but it would ultimately go to the vote for the people to have the final say. That attracted some people who said, well, it's an easier vote to take, you know, because I'm not ultimately making the decision. I'm just voting to sort of send it to the people. But he also lost actually more votes than he gained by doing that for the very fear that if this went to the ballot this year, it would lose. And when you go to the ballot and lose, you set back a cause for a good 10 years, you know. So that was the sense that this is not a good year. It's an off year, low turnout, typically a more conservative electorate. So they were scared about that very thing. I think if they go to the ballot, so a citizen movement generates and there's already a group thinking about this, it's not going to be before next year and maybe not even before 2016 when you have sort of bigger turnout elections, a bluer electorate, if you will, that they would do this.
Although the polling did find a pretty large majority in Washington State as a whole for universal background checks. And so I do think the discussion of which year to run this is important, but I think it's been demonstrated, at least from the polling, that theoretically this can win. And actually the main question is when Nick Hanauer, who's funding this new group that's popped up to push for gun control at the state level, is willing to write the check for the signature gatherers, whether he decides to do that this year or next year. And probably he is having this discussion with his advisors about which year he gets more bang for his buck.
He could save money just by listening to us. You have any thoughts?
Well, clearly there's nothing is gained by a massacre. We've had brutal murders, massacres here in Washington State, the Cafe Racer being the most notable example. And gun control legislation always gets proposed. It always dies in Olympia. I think going to the ballot is the way to try and get something done. I'm not sure, you know, you could argue, well, we should do it right away because we've got momentum because of Sandy Hook. Because the special interest in the different constituencies and everything, just this, the lobbying groups and whatnot, it just gets very complicated when you try and. So I think an initiative is a great idea. I don't know about the timing issues, but I think that's where it's going to happen. It's not going to happen in Olympia.
The problem with Newtown is Newtown was not a great test case for background checks, nor was Aurora, and for that matter, nor was Cafe Racer here, our own sort of local version of that. All these perpetrators either got the guns illegally or, in the case of Newtown, he stole them from his mom. So background checks wouldn't have changed any of those. And you know, that's part of the problem here is that there's not a great connect for some of these wavering legislators between some of the massacres, as much as we want them to stop and end them, and this particular piece of legislation.
What's happening in the House right now in terms of the budget as the Republicans and the Democrats move towards some sort of budget? Now, we're waiting for the financial forecast next week. We saw the budget shortfall grow by $300 million. This week, state miscalculated how much money it was going to save from moving people to managed care, Medicaid patients to managed care. Is this giving people a way to promote their agenda, get things accomplished, or is it now are we all just frozen while we wait for the forecast because of this growing budget for shortfall? What do you guys think? Anybody have thoughts?
The math is already pretty clear, whether the shortfall is $1 billion, $1.3 billion, more than $1.3 billion, you have this tremendous shortfall. Plus, you have the order from the state Supreme Court to invest $1 billion toward education because of the McCleary decision. So there's $2 billion plus that the legislature needs to come up with. And no clear way to do that without raising revenue, except the legislature is committed to not raising revenue. At least the Republican majority in the Senate is. So the basic math does not work at this point, and it will be very interesting to see how they deal with it, because when the new revenue forecast comes out, the math is only going to get more challenging.
The Republicans in the House, 2% cut state agencies. That's $100 million, they say. That's efficiencies, they call it. $200 million in budget transfers. So I think that's what people complain about, right, where they just move the money around. And would net $80 million by eliminating a tax break for telecommunications company. I think that's about as far as they went. They still seem to be in a conundrum.
Well, I think one thing that is interesting is what you just mentioned, this telecom tax break. You know, I think two things are going to put revenue back on the table. One is, as Eli says, the budget hole is getting bigger and is likely to get bigger next week when the revenue forecast comes out. And also the Iman initiative was thrown out, so you now don't need two-thirds to get something out of the legislature. And that House Republicans last week presented a plan that actually closes a telecom loophole. Right, and that's actually a big deal. I mean, because the fight is going to be, no one's going to propose a general tax increase. You know, the question is, how many loopholes are you going to close? And they've been very hard to close at two-thirds. They've done it a couple times. But for the most part, they've been off the table. So I think revenue, even House Republicans are talking about it. So I think you've got the sort of workings of a balanced approach. And actually, Gary Alexander, the chair of the House Republicans.
That's what he called it.
Yeah, he said it's a balanced approach.
And I believe, when I was writing about the tax loophole situation last year and the year before, I believe when someone tallied it up, there are something like $6.5 billion worth of loopholes that the state loses money through every year or every 2 years. So theoretically, if we were to close them all up tomorrow, which might not be a good idea for the state, by the way, because some of them
are... Your loophole is my stimulus.
Well, yes, and our loophole is in everyone who's at this table and listening includes, for example, you could call the lack of a tax on food a loophole. The state loses a lot of money because of that, but it's important. And so I don't know that you can get enough savings out of closing loopholes in a wise way. If you want to just do a kind of slash and burn with the loopholes, you can theoretically get there. But if you're being smart about it, I don't know. And I think then what you're left with is revenue.
All right. Unless you have any thoughts on that, I shall take a break.
I'll believe that they'll close loopholes that are significant when they do it. I mean,
when they discover life on Mars.
Exactly. I want to see the actual things in the Petri dish. You know, I mean, this comes up all the time. Everybody talks about it, but lobbying groups are so powerful that it's easy to derail. And going back to gun control, I mean, look at the power of a lobby. The majority of members of the NRA believe in background checks, and they still can't pass background checks because the NRA officially opposes it now, although they once supported it. And, so when you start talking about poking at Boeing or Microsoft or the large agricultural interests, good luck.
That's a big bear.
Good luck.
All right, we'll take a break. This is Weekday.
It's 1043 KUOW 94.9. Every day, KUOW keeps you connected to events here at home and around the world, but we can't do it without you. Your financial support makes it all possible. You may have recently received an appeal in the mail. Please mail in your gift today or give online at KUOW.org. Your support right now will help keep our upcoming spring pledge drive on target so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. And thanks.
This is Brooke Gladstone, and on the next On the Media, we consider what it might mean if WikiLeaks leaker Bradley Manning is convicted of abetting the enemy.
This means that every time you leak a national security document that can be accessed over the net from everywhere, you are indirectly communicating with the enemy.
That and more on the next On the Media.
Sunday night at 6 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. The crew from Pike Place Fish will share recipes from their new book, In the Kitchen with the Pike Place Fish Guys, 100 recipes and tips from the world-famous crew of Pike Place Fish. From Viking, Thursday, March 21st, 7 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave.
52 degrees in Seattle's University District, expecting a high around 53 today, clouds and showers likely. Also breezy. Tonight, expect a low in the upper 40s with clouds and a 40% chance of showers.
We are reviewing the news with some people who tweet at Eli J. Sanders, at CR Douglas, Q13 Fox, and one who Facebook friends. You'll friend anybody.
What does that mean?
It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. Kitty Burgess on Facebook. I will. I friend everybody who wants to friend me on Facebook.
There you go.
I'm gonna
use
it.
Have some pretty exotic friends from countries around the world.
I'm trying. And I just look at what they have to say. All right. I want to come back to politics a little bit, but just locally. But before I do, Chris Christie got disinvited to take the stage at the Conservative Political Action Committee conference, where they are talking about remaking the party and making the party more open to young people and a broader coalition of a broader base of Americans. Are they talking out of both sides of their mouth, or are they really just talking out of one side and the rest of it's just nice rhetoric? What do you think?
Well, he's still getting punished for having bear hugged the president during the Sandy storm. You know, he is, I think, the single best chance for Republicans to gain the White House. And odds are that he will run. And odds are, you know, a lot of good research shows he can win this thing. But he doesn't toe, you know, he's a maverick. This is why he's an interesting guy to a lot of people. And he doesn't toe a purely conservative line, which is the reason he didn't get invited. But listen, if you are a red politician in a blue state like New Jersey, give him a break. I mean, this is don't Republicans want, you know, leaders in these kinds of states? You know, do you want to? He wouldn't get elected in New Jersey if he was a Rand Paul. You know. And so it strikes me as a missed opportunity not to bring him in and not to show that, listen, he's a legitimate, powerful force to be reckoned with in that party.
And a foreshadowing of the way the Republican Party may continue to eat its own in the primary process. I mean, CPAC is just, in a way, an early, early version of the primaries, which, remember how long that lasted and what we went through and all the purity tests that there were. And the problem with the Republican Party is it's got too many purity tests that are way out of sync with what the American people think is actually pure.
I don't remember if it was Rand Paul or somebody commenting on Rand Paul around CPAC saying that the only way Republicans will win or maintain their power is to be purely conservative. They were listening to old Ronald Reagan speeches about that. Not somebody who necessarily follows in the mold.
Even Ronald Reagan couldn't please Rand Paul, who would have made a great, you know, president of the Confederacy. I mean, you know, Rand Paul is it's interesting. I mean, the party is you can't judge everything by CPAC, but you know, judge by that. He's the new Sarah Palin, the new kind of rock star of the Republican Party, took on drones. And he has a version of the sort of Ron Paul libertarian message. And this is becoming last time this part, this segment of the Republican Party was in ascendance was in the Goldwater era. And so it's a strain within the party, and it happens to be part of the identity crisis that's going on. It's a strain that has a kind of test to it, a strong test. They want ideological purity. They want a kind of libertarian approach that's not pragmatic, because pragmatic means compromises. That means they don't like Republicans who they think of as just basically conservative Democrats. They look at a Chris Christie or a Rudolph Giuliani or you know, people of that ilk. I would think if you were a Republican, you would look at the electoral map and say, we can win the South, we can win the West. Wouldn't it be great to pick off states like Virginia, Pennsylvania, where you might not, you might win the state or you might not, but you might peel off, somebody like a Chris Christie might peel off a big chunk of suburban voters who, you know, are not going to like, you know, an extremist. I would think that would be a viable sort of strategy.
I'm sure they're going to be listening. I mean, I'm sure in the end they probably are going to be listening to you.
There was an interesting development on the continued push and pull within the Republican Party. I think it was last night. Rob Portman, who was, if I'm remembering right, on the short list of vice presidential contenders, said that his son is gay and that he supports gay marriage. So he essentially came out about a gay family member and took a position that is out of step with the CPAC core of the Republican Party.
Let me come back to the election again, or really more about what's happening in Seattle, and maybe I'm going to kind of bring all these together. But Crosscut, Matt Fitzy-Burkirk had this article about the new surveillance city, he called it, the beginning of citywide surveillance, Seattle's new waterfront cameras. He was looking into the paperwork and trying to figure out what all these surveillance cameras that are popping up will mean. That's going to be an issue, I would expect, that all these candidates for mayor are going to take up. What did you learn from what this system that's, you know, in place, coming into place, will mean for us?
Well, I thought it was great. You know, Matt has hundreds of documents he's actually been reading, so we don't have to. And, you know, it turns out this so-called port surveillance system surveils a lot more than just the port. It captures a lot of capture a lot of information. It has the potential to tie into a larger Homeland Security network. This did not get the scrutiny that drones has. It's not, and this is the kind of thing. I mean, I think people express some legitimate concerns about drones. But here's a system that kind of breezed through the council, was approved by the mayor, and didn't get any of the vetting that drones got. And
federal money,
potentially,
right?
Yes, a lot of federal money. And it's very difficult when, you know, you offer a police department basically free toys or free tools, and you say, well, you know, we'll pick up the $6 million cost or $4 million cost, whatever that is. You know, it's very hard to say no, but these things do have effects. And so I thought his piece was really excellent, just going through in detail and saying, look, there's serious questions that should be asked about this program. Here's six or seven questions. There's a meeting coming up next week in which this will people will be able to ask those questions. But it's way down the pike as compared with the drone program.
But I think this may be the police issue where the mayor is the most vulnerable in a sense. He, both on drones and on surveillance, to the average person seems like someone caught off guard by something that he should have known was happening. He ended up having to send the drones back to the manufacturer after thinking about it more. He seemed to have a lack of information, just like everyone else, about what this surveillance system on the waterfront actually was. And that is a very clear opening for people running for mayor to say, I will be someone who actually pays attention to what the police are doing as it relates to citizen privacy. That could be a very potent argument.
I don't know if it'll get a huge amount of traction. I mean, after all, he did sort of bow to public pressure and kill the drone program. And in terms of camera surveillance, he basically has kept the lights off, if you will. They will not go active until they've sort of settled this and sort of allayed everyone's fears about privacy. My guess is over time, the cameras will survive. I think sort of fixed mounted cameras in select locations with sort of blinders on them so you don't see into houses and all that kind of stuff can kind of be worked out, and that privacy hawks can be sort of calmed in a way that the drones were much more unpredictable. I mean, sort of fly anywhere, look into anything. That's different than a fixed camera system. This is not that unusual. I mean, we're talking about 30 cameras or something. I mean, Chicago has, what, 5,000, 6,000? I mean, Washington, D.C. has thousands. I mean, Baltimore. I mean, cameras are all over the place. England has more cameras than probably the world combined. I mean, these are not that unprecedented. They're used by law enforcement. They have figured out ways to not have them look above the first floor and all that kind of stuff. And I think if that is sort of enshrined into these, and the council sort of, you know, picks this up and gets the rules and regulations right, that this will probably, you know, end up going online. And I don't know if it's going to hurt the mayor all that much, because he did stop it before it went on.
It'd be interesting to see some studies that correlate the surveillance society with crime rates.
Well, and just to briefly, it's very mixed.
I know.
It's very mixed. So, I mean, that's the question here. We talk about privacy, but like the purpose of these is sort of to combat crime and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, there's a good discussion about whether they do and under what conditions. How many do you have to have? Should they be monitored 24 hours? I mean, there are a lot of sort of studies to show that where they work and where they don't. But the track record is mixed.
And just to add, the current state of drone technology is actually not as potent as this surveillance system that's being set up would be. Drones right now have a battery life of only like 10 or so minutes, and they can't fly in a lot of adverse weather conditions. These cameras, the way that they're being designed, would be more of a force in people's everyday continuous lives than any police drone would right now.
I think Seattle has a culture where there's a high expectation of a level of privacy. And in terms of people, there are a lot of things they do in London that we wouldn't find acceptable. The number of, you know, surveillance cameras per square inch, tolls to get into downtown. I think people, it's part of not just American culture, but West Coast culture. You come here, you're free to do what you want. People here don't even like the red light cameras. And have concerns about that. So I think Eli made a good point, and this is very important for a mayor as McGinn is, who's touted his progressive thinking on technology and wiring the city and getting that dark cable fired up so we can all get high-speed internet access, et cetera, is if you're going to be the tech mayor, you got to look at all the technology, all the high-tech stuff. And these cameras, what do you do with the data? Where does it go? Who sees it? What does it tap into? What do the feds get access to? You're talking about cameras in public places where people going about their business can be watched. And that's not to say there isn't a argument to be made for them, but it's to say that, you know, in Seattle, if it's a privacy issue, you better vet it.
Which is another way of saying, if you're going to be the tech mayor, you also need to be the civil liberties mayor, because all of these technologies that are so rapidly advancing are constantly bumping up against privacy concerns. And in Seattle, especially, you can't turn a blind eye to that side of it.
Yeah. And if you want to make an argument that we're just living in a post-privacy age, none of us really have privacy.
Good luck winning the mayor's race.
Good luck winning the mayor's race. But go ahead, make that argument. That the privacy is a thing of the past.
All right, there are two issues.
There are two issues I didn't get to. And Knut wrote two articles on the Space Needle views and on what's happening in South Lake Union, which I'm coming back to next week because it's a topic I like. And it
won't go away.
And it will not go away. Well, the views may. But the topic won't.
The topic won't go away.
That's we can it. Just watch them through a camera.
There you go. Problem solved. Eli J. Sanders tweets at Eli J. Sanders. C.R. Douglas tweets at C.R. Douglas Q13 Fox. Knut's on Facebook. We're on Facebook. We get four more friends to like us. Then we'll reach 4,500, which is just the beginning of the empire we are building. Jack Walters is our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Saadi, Andy Hurst. You folks have a good weekend. You guys
you too.
Steve.
You too.
This is Weekday.
It's 10:59. KUOW 94.9.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad. We all...
Soundview School, a North End preschool through 8th grade International Baccalaureate World School focused on integrating arts and academics. Currently accepting applications for the 2013-2014 academic year. More at soundview.org.
You're tuned to KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.